Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This Wednesday here in Milwaukee, there's going to be a summit on the problem of heroin addiction in southeast Wisconsin. It's taking place at Marquette University. Healthcare providers, law enforcement officers, families who have members struggling with addiction, and politicians from the region will be attending. And the featured speaker is Representative John Nygren of Marinette. His daughter has been battling heroin addiction, and he has authored several bills to address the problem. This hour, we will be speaking with him later in the hour, and Dr. Michael Miller is joining us at the top of the hour. He is a psychiatrist and addictionologist. He is medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, board-certified general psychiatrist and addiction psychiatrist who's practiced addiction medicine for more than 30 years. He serves as a faculty member for the Addiction Psychiatry Fellowship and the Addiction Medicine Fellowship at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and has lectured throughout the U.S. and internationally on addiction medicine. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. We've done a number of shows on this issue after we realized how large the problem is in many places in Wisconsin, urban, rural problem, suburban problem. There have been at least 206 heroin-related deaths in Wisconsin in 2012 and 227 deaths in 2013. So we'll look at why this seems to be a drug that a lot of people are going to. Is it mostly young people? How severe is the addiction? Why do people use heroin? How easy is it to become addicted? How hard is it to kick the addiction is the focus of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dr. Michael Miller, hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Very nice to be with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's talk about how extensive, all of a sudden, this has come to our attention in a large way in the country and in the state of Wisconsin. How substantial and how growing a problem, from your perspective, is opioid addiction and heroin addiction?
Well, they've been called an epidemic by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and by the White House Office of Drug Control Policy, the Drug Czar's Office, and I think those characterizations are spot on. The rates have gone up significantly, I would say almost doubled as far as the rates of addiction. The number of prescriptions of opioids has gone up about tenfold in a decade. The number of deaths due to opioids has gone up about threefold in the last decade. And we now find that as this trend evolved, we would say, well, there are now 15 states in which the number of people who die each year from opioids exceeds traffic deaths.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, then it was 30 states. Now it's the whole nation.
Wow.
More people now die from drug overdoses than die from auto crashes. Now, not all of those are opioid deaths. There's opioids mixed with sedatives like benzodiazepines. There's a few stimulant deaths, but this is the problem. And more people are dying from opioid pill deaths. These are legitimate pharmaceuticals originating with a legal prescription from a doctor than getting diverted through people stealing from medicine cabinets and things like that. More people are dying from the pills than from heroin, which is really shocking. But the heroin is now piggybacking on to the pill addiction issues. And as we have more people, including young people, who are addicted to pills like oxycodone and hydrocodone and morphine, then they transition into heroin because of availability and price. And now we have a heroin problem in the United States that's different than it's ever looked before. And my cynical comment is that, you know, the Dust Bowl was a big problem, but nobody cared until the dust cloud got to Washington, D.C. back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. When things hit policymakers and people in the media. It affects the neighborhoods they live in. It really gets people's attention. When this was a problem for minority neighborhoods, it didn't get the attention it's getting now because it's every community. It's tiny communities. It's not just big cities. It's majority kids, not just minority kids. It's everybody's kids. Mm-hmm. It's your kids and my kids.
Right.
Anybody's at risk. And so it's the attention it's getting is appropriate. And thank you so much, and Wisconsin Public Radio, for bringing all the attention to this, because you're not overdoing it.
Right. Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm wondering why it is. Does it say something on about our society that more people are going to either these prescription drugs or to heroin? Does it say something about how difficult it is to be alive? Or is it, what is it? Why are more people turning to these kinds of drugs, and some just have a very, very hard time knocking it? I don't quite understand that.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's more complex than we could probably address in an hour, as far as the cultural issues and what is it about America, what is it about the disconnectedness since we sort of lost our neighborhoods where all the kids played together after school, and we had communities, and everybody's mom knew what everybody else's kids were doing, and all of the cultural changes that have happened, the fragmentation of families. We could talk about that. We could certainly talk about the mentality of Americans of wanting quick responses, immediate gratification. It's all about me. And we could talk about the sense of actual entitlement that people have, that they actually believe that they should feel great all the time. The whole pain issue is particularly vexing, because for chronic pain syndromes, the key target should be functionality, and complete comfort is not a feasible endpoint, though a lot of people think that, so they just look to a pill to solve the problem. And we certainly have, it's been called Generation RX, kids that feel like there's a pill for everything. We've got the whole notion of everybody needs to take an antidepressant, every college student needs to take a stimulant. All of those trends, I don't want to trivialize them. I don't know that they're the driving factor, their background, but addiction rates in general, they've been where they've been forever. They're, 12-14%, and it's international, it's cross-cultural. Addiction's a brain disease, and it affects some cultures a little bit more, Northern Europeans, Native Americans a little bit more, Asians a little bit less. There's some international cultural differences, but addiction is just part of the human condition. Mm-hmm. And it's over 10% of the population. It's just that, what is the drug du jour? And we went through the cocaine epidemic in the 80s. Now it's the opioid epidemic. Where did the cocaine come from? We could talk about that. It's much less now. Opioids are the big thing now, and they're lethal.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked that question. It was a very interesting response. And when you say 12 to 14%, do you mean 12 to 14% of people are addicted to these, or 12 to 14% are just using them sometimes, or what?
Oh, no. 12 to 14% of the public in their adult lifetime will have chemical addiction to alcohol, tobacco.
12 to 14%, that high. Wow.
Big number, yeah.
Yeah. And that's because these affect the brain differently in people, so that somebody could drink and not become an alcoholic or take a prescription drug. I'm not sure about heroin. I've heard that's incredibly addictive. But you could take some of these and you'd be okay. But if you had a brain that was susceptible to disease from this, then you're not okay?
You've got that right. That is the message. Addiction is not about drugs. It's about brains. It's about how your brain responds when you use. And 85%, close to 90% of people can use without developing loss of control, preoccupation, and the whole addiction picture. Because it's such a large percent, because well over 80% of people can use alcohol, even drugs, and not get addicted, they don't understand that loss of control is a very real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Preoccupation really happens. They have a hard time really getting it. But it is about what happens in the brains of the person with addiction when they use these drugs. And a trite statement that sounds silly is, addictive drugs are addictive for addicts. They're not addictive for non-addicts.
Mm-hmm.
So non-addicts can go to the casino. Non-addicts can have alcohol. Non-addicts can smoke pot. Non-addicts can take pain pills after surgery. Non-addicts can do a lot of things. The most addictive drugs intrinsically are nicotine and stimulants.
What about heroin?
heroin is really interesting, and we really need to update the data that we have, the science we have. The the good article that was written on this was written in the early 90s by a researcher at Michigan State, James Anthony. He's still working, and he wrote this article, and he showed that of the percentage of regular users who develop addiction was highest for nicotine and stimulants. For pills like Valium and other sedatives, and stimulants like Adderall and Ritalin. And at that point, pain pills, this is back in the early 90s, the data said it was about 9%. And marijuana falls right in there. So the idea that marijuana is not addictive isn't supported by the evidence at all.
Hmm.
So about 9%. But in that study, IV heroin was 35%. It was far beyond even smoking cigarettes. But at that in that era, all the IV heroin was pretty much being used in very challenging inner-city neighborhoods, our major port cities of New York, Baltimore, Boston, Los Angeles, Chicago. Wasn't out in the hinterlands at all. There was not much nasal use of heroin back then. Wasn't all the pill use. So the demographics and the epidemiology of the current opiate epidemic are really different than the IV heroin that was around through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so we don't know. Mm-hmm. We really don't know, but that because that data now is 20 years old and was before this current epidemic really hit.
Hmm. Interesting. So when somebody comes to the hospital and you got to get them clean before you can do much of anything, how do you get people clean? How big a process is that? What do people – I have heard we had a couple heroin former addicts with us, very young kids really, a few weeks ago, and they just described this agonizing process of how hard it was to – one of them just did it on her own, and she just described in great detail how agonizing it was. What do you do? Why is it so hard, and are there drugs available now that will ease that process for people so becoming drug-free is not as painful?
Perfectly phrased question. It has to do with agony. It doesn't have to do with danger. It's not like heroin withdrawal is dangerous. The sort of trite statement is, opiate withdrawal won't kill you, but you'll wish you were dead.
Mm.
The dangerous withdrawal is alcohol, sedatives, so Valium, Xanax, barbiturates. That's what's dangerous. That can cause hallucinations, seizures, delirium, all sorts of things. People die of alcohol withdrawal. People do not, absolutely do not die of heroin withdrawal. The rare situation, maybe they would aspirate their own vomit if they were throwing up, but that is like so rare. Opioid withdrawal is not dangerous. It's just terribly uncomfortable.
Mm.
And the discomfort may well have to do with what a neurochemist would call dopamine withdrawal, that people are missing the effects of the chemical that gives joy and gives pleasure and gives reward. And so they are absolutely in emotional agony. So the biggest issue with opioid withdrawal is this big emotional component to withdrawal. People can also look and feel very depressed and even feel suicidal. That's usually pretty short-lived, and suicide during heroin withdrawal is certainly very rare. But with nicotine, people have withdrawal, and interestingly, it's not the degree of emotional agony. There's a physical withdrawal, and the main issue with nicotine is people return to use to self-medicate their withdrawal, and with opioids, that's what people do. They can't tolerate the withdrawal, so they go and get another dose.
Mm.
And so establishing abstinence is the thing that the patients call getting over the hump. They want to just get through the detox phase. They want to get through this acute phase that can last 3 or 4 days. It can last up to 10 days. Basically would not last beyond 10 days. It's usually 4 to 6, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people need to be physically separated from access to drugs. And this is where the insurance world hasn't figured this out at all.
Mm-hmm.
The insurance world says they're not going to die. There's tons of literature saying this is not dangerous. They don't need to be in a structured environment to withdraw. And for the management, there are medicines you can give. And ironically, the main thing we use these days is a medicine that was discovered by accident. It's a blood pressure medicine called clonidine that actually treats part of the withdrawal process. It doesn't do that great a job on the emotional withdrawal process. What you're probably asking, or thought I would answer you as far as new medicines to treat withdrawal, is buprenorphine, which is has been available since 2003. It hit the retail drugstores, so it's been around for about 11 years now. Initial trade name was Suboxone. There's new trade names now. One is called Zubsolve, and then there's some new products coming on the market, maybe even later this year. But buprenorphine is an excellent medicine for treating opioid withdrawal, and it can work in a matter of minutes to really take away some of the physical symptoms and the emotional symptoms and really get people feeling so good. And the thing that's fascinating is when a doctor is prescribing this in a controlled environment, the person's not just doing it on their own. What can happen is the person feels really good without feeling the euphoria of an opioid high, and when they do take it for a number of days and they get on maintenance treatment for the opioid addiction, what they self-report in many cases is, I feel like I did before I began using. It's just an amazing thing that restores the brain almost to the state it was as far as emotional well-being before they got on the roller coaster with using, again, whatever it is, Dilaudid, oxycodone, Vicodin, heroin on a regular basis. So, yes, there are new medicines. They are available. They're pretty darn effective. And so it's important that people know about them.
But there's also this component that I know you do as part of your treatment program. It would be a whole different thing if you got this and the withdrawal, you got the drug, you were on your own a few days, you felt a little bit better. But there's another component, and I know you do group therapy. How critical is that to getting a person well again?
Very good. Most people don't really have a clear conception of what recovery from addiction may involve. And in fact, they'll use the term like going to detox for 30 days, which you don't do. Detox is the withdrawal management part that just takes a few days. Rehab is another term we use for the treatment of the addiction part, where you actually turn your life around and you develop new coping skills, you learn skills, behavioral skills to avoid returning to drugs. You get relapse prevention therapy, where you identify the triggers to drug use. You change your behavioral repertoire. You stay out of the people, places, and things that led you back to drug use before. You do use group therapy methods. You use family therapy methods. These are the things that treat the chronic addiction process after the person's been stabilized with regard to the acute withdrawal process. So there's withdrawal management, which just takes a few days. There's addiction management, which actually takes a lifetime. But the intensive treatment phase will last for 2 or 3 weeks to 2 to 3 months. People should remain engaged with treatment for a couple of years, and very few people do. People should be case managed over time, and you should deal with this as a chronic disease, just like diabetes or hypertension. And those sort of methods are just now appearing within the medical repertoire. And so, how do you treat it? For those of us who have had the opportunity to work with this for years and be well-trained, it's not that mysterious about what you do. You stay engaged with the patient. You change their social network. You work with their family supports. You push them toward productive daily activities so that they have accountabilities every day and have their daily structure filled. And you monitor them, and you stay with them for months, stay with them for a couple of years. Make sure that if they hit a stressful time in the road, it's just a bump in the road and they don't slip back into drug use. So there certainly are a variety of psychosocial treatment methods that are very effective. A lot of times when I'm asked to give talks these days, it's, tell me about the new medications that are available to treat opioid addiction. And I'm happy to talk about those, and I'm on the speakers bureaus for some pharmaceutical companies. I really believe in what these medicines can do to help people, But it's not all about the medicines, I promise you. And it's about the psychosocial rehabilitation, right, about the counseling, and it's about going to NA as well, so Narcotics Anonymous, and doing the self-help part. So everything fits together. And if you do them all together, if you do professional help, self-help, medication management, talk therapies, that's when you get the best results.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour, most of the hour, is Dr. Michael Miller. He's medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. He is a psychiatrist and an addiction psychiatrist, has practiced medicine in this area for more than 30 years. We're talking again. We wanted to devote, we've done a number of programs on these issues. Our last program was with recovering addicts, very young people who became addicted to heroin at very young ages, and talked about their addiction and their recovery process. So this hour, we wanted to look at treatment, and we're welcoming phone calls. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. When he talked about the extensive kind of treatment program that needs to take place, I wonder about, how do you pay for this? Have insurance companies realized how vast this problem is and how much treatment is needed? Is that a problem in America right now? 2-year phone calls, and they're lining up fast here in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Dr. Michael Miller, medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital, board-certified general psychiatrist and addiction psychiatrist, Liz in Fitchburg. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Miller.
Hey.
My son is a heroin addict, has been for a number of years, and has been in and out of treatment, and was finally sober for 2 years. Unfortunately, started using again. And it's pure agony for families. I'm at the point now where I have had to leave them go. And I just want to point out that we've tried all of the things that you've mentioned, and some of them work, some of them don't. And if you don't have luck the first time, you just keep trying. But it is agony for families. We're waiting for the phone call in a way that says that something has happened to him. Sometimes we don't know where he is. But I just wanted to say that in the midst of all of this agony and pain for families, I still adhere to the mantra that you never give up, that even though relapses happen, and, even after being sober for a while, you just never give up, because you never know when, just at that right time, something may click and it may finally start working a little bit better. And you may have your son or your daughter back again to being a sober individual. So anyway, I just want to thank you, Dr. Miller, for the work that you do. I know this is not easy work. It's long and it's arduous, and sometimes the results aren't as what you want them to be. But thank you for the work that you do. I have to say.
You're so kind to call in, Liz, and we wish you and your son the best through these struggles. You've gained a lot of wisdom through the School of Hard Knocks on this, realizing that hope is extremely important, and I think that may be the most important thing that I do, is to try to impart hope for individuals and families when it's hard for them to see that there is hope. But I'm looking at a website right now where the word HOPE is right up at the top in the graphics, and I want people to be aware of it. It's the Parent Addiction Network of Dane County, which has been established as part of a task force in our county that was begun over 2 years ago by our county executive and our mayor in Madison. And Safe Communities is the not-for-profit that's running this opioid project in Dane County. And one of the things they've done is established the Parent Addiction Network. So it's Safer Community, SAFER with no space, community.net. And safercommunity.net will give you links to all sorts of stuff about the opioid problem that Safe Communities is addressing. And if you can remember to backslash this, or maybe Kathleen can put it on the WPR
website. Sure, we'll do that.
It's safercommunity.net/parent_addiction_network.php. And so families can get together. Al-Anon has been around for many years, AA, of course, since 1935, but Nar-Anon is specifically for family members where there is the drug problem. But these family support groups are really important, and it's just an inspiring phone call that you placed today, and thank you so much for doing it.
Yeah.
We certainly hope for good things for your son going forward. And you never can predict who's going to do well and who's not going to do well. No therapist should be arrogant enough to think they can tell the future. So you hold out hope and you do everything you can to set it up for people to give them their best chance.
Thanks, Liz, for the call. When she said you never know what it is in life, what event may take place that would allow her son to make a switch and just to be recovered forever. After all these years in this area, are there moments that are ripe? Are there moments that where you're more likely to become clean than others, or is it pretty much unpredictable?
I really don't know. I had the opportunity to work with Christopher Kennedy Lawford on one of his books.
Oh, you did? Oh, sure. We interviewed him. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, he's a great interview. And
yes.
He was in Madison a couple of years ago to talk to Shelley Dutch's Recovery Foundation luncheon. It was wonderful. But one of his books is entitled Moments of Clarity. And he talked with, he basically did a Studs Terkel type thing where he just interviewed people and let them tell their story. What was their moment of clarity? And it's, of course, Bill W. and Dr. Bob talked about hitting bottom. You know, what is the transformational moment? What's the existential moment for you? We don't know when it's going to happen. Sometimes we can look back and notice that it happened, and some people in AA and NA call it a spiritual awakening. But, you know, what is your moment of clarity when you finally see things? And as I worked with the American Society of Addiction Medicine to develop its definition of addiction, and you can find that on our website, asam.org, I had the honor of working with a group of, oh, my God, probably several dozen addiction doctors working for years literally developing this definition. But one of the phrases I contributed to it was that one of the core features of addiction is a diminished recognition of the problems that your addiction has caused you and people around you. It's this denial process of diminished recognition where everybody in the world sees the world in a particular way, and you view the world very differently. You say, it's not that bad. My kids aren't affected. My pocketbook's not affected. My health's not affected. This won't kill me. I'm doing okay. People just need to get off my back. And the family goes, what planet are you on? It's very clear to us something's wrong. And so the moment of clarity is almost when you sort of rejoin the human race and you come back and you see the world the way other people see it, and you stop this idiosyncratic worldview that says, I'm doing fine, because really you're not doing fine. And so, you know, when will that happen? We can't predict when it will happen, but Liz was correct. And we know it best from the nicotine treatment literature that the best results come from the people that have tried the most times. You know, we used to think that, you know, once you've tried to quit six times, why try again? You'll never make it.
Right.
Keep trying. We don't know which time's going to work, so try to keep the hope going.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Liz. Eric in Madison. Hello, Eric.
Hi. This is a great conversation today. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was really curious to ask your guest about if there's any research done on why maybe certain, you hear about addictive personalities, and why is it that maybe someone can stop smoking, you know, the next day and never smoke again, versus someone that can't, you know, they can't stop drinking the next day or whatever. Like, you know, why is it that certain addictive drugs don't affect the person in the same way? I mean, you know, like, it's not that I've seen folks that can have a lot of addictions and then at a moment's notice drop three of the four or whatever. You know, it's just I'm wondering what the brain works on how that works, I guess.
Do we
well,
know
you're,
the,
you're yeah. asking profound questions.
Right.
And I don't want to bore Kathleen's wonderful
No,
audience,
you're not boring us at all.
but I got into this in a very interesting way. I was taking a liberal arts curriculum in college, really enjoyed my philosophy classes, was fascinated with epistemology, which is the philosophy of knowledge, and how do we know something to be true? So some of the questions are really philosophical. How do we know how the brain works? How do we know what perception is? And so I ended up deciding to go into psychiatry just because I wanted something where I could, you know, get my arms around some of these philosophical questions, but in a practical way where you could do something about them. And so the questions you're asking about addiction are the questions that the best addictionologists in the world ask all the time. We're trying to grapple with this, but what we've learned the last 20 years of brain science advancements, we used to think that if we understood the reward circuitry of the brain, we knew addiction. But in fact, the reward circuitry tells us why a drug is rewarding and what gets us high and what intoxication is about. But that's not the chronic disease. The chronic disease has to do with memory of past experiences, the focus of motivation, the primacy of the reward, picking your drug over everything else you could possibly do, including raising your kids, and the inhibitory control that comes from the frontal lobe and the tempering influences on the desire to get high. And there are many brain areas that interact in a fascinating way, and it seems that the addictive process is that in certain people, when they do take these very powerful unnatural rewards, and actually even liquor is more powerful than the natural reward of looking at a pretty sunset or a pretty painting and going, isn't that nice? But these powerful rewards like pharmaceuticals and, of course, heroin and nicotine, when you have a certain makeup of your brain, and I would not call it your personality, but when you have a certain makeup of your brain, when you hit that reward center and the dopamine system starts really going, it starts a cascade of events that involve other brain areas, the amygdala, the hippocampus, the cingulate gyrus, the prefrontal cortex. And then you have this symphony of brain areas that are operating off the tracks, just off the tracks. And normal rewards aren't as rewarding. And all of behavior is focused on pursuing these unnatural rewards. Where can I get my next one? Where can I get my next one? Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen to normal people.
Mm-hmm.
Normal people can sample things and not go off the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we tell who these people are? We need more brain science on it, brain science research.
Mm.
Great question.
Yeah, thank you so much, Eric. John in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, thank you,
I was just wondering what the doctor had to say about, I've heard the theory that some of the people who tend to get addicted to opioids have a lack of endogenous endorphins themselves. That was one of my questions. And I was also wondering who, if anybody, you know, other than the people that have a high risk of relapse should remain on lifelong treatment with buprenorphine or methadone. And then finally, I think the prescriptive authority for these drugs are limited right now to physicians. With the growing problem, should we consider opening, allowing, you know, PAs and NPs to prescribe these drugs?
Yeah, those are really, really great questions. Give me the first one again because I remember the second two better.
The theory that people
who tend to get addicted to opioids
have a lack of endogenous endorphins themselves.
Got it. The theory about lack of endogenous endorphins, endorphins are your internal opioids. Again, we don't have receptors for morphine in our brain because of morphine. We have receptors in our brain for chemicals that our body naturally produces, and these are the endorphins and enkephalins that our brain produces that interact with those systems and that mediate our reward circuitry. You know, that hypothesis is out there. I think a stronger hypothesis is that people have deficits in their dopamine system. Either they don't have enough receptors, they don't have enough sensitivity of receptors. There's like this dopamine lack, and what happens is for some people, when they take one of these unnatural rewards, like a tablet of codeine, or in some people even a shot of bourbon, for the first time at ages 11, 13, 15, 18, it's like the world changes from black and white to technicolor.
Oh, my.
It's just this sudden thing, and they go, oh, this is what life is? So there is a subset. Now, how many is it? Is it 5%, 10%, 20% of people with addiction? We just don't have that kind of knowledge yet. But the hypothesis that there's something missing, that drugs fill that emptiness, that's one worth pursuing. The next question had to do with who needs to be on lifelong medication.
Right.
Very controversial question. And I would say that I certainly have had patients on lifetime treatment for opioid addiction using methadone or buprenorphine. We don't have research now on the neurobiology of recovery and what happens to the brain to change it to heal back, to get back to the way it was in the pre-addicted state. And we don't know, if you don't know the process, then you can't determine which psychotherapy or pharmacotherapy will affect that. So we know that there are some people that need it lifetime, and I think we shouldn't have any stigma against them, and we shouldn't have insurance barriers against them. There are some people that are going to need it. And I suggest 2 years of stability before you even try to go off those medications. So that was a very interesting question you asked. With regard to the prescribing authority, again, you're a very knowledgeable listener here. Buprenorphine is, like methadone, an opioid that treats opioid addiction. The misconception is you're substituting one addiction for another, which you absolutely are not. You're substituting one opioid for another. Buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist. You cannot overdose on it by itself. It's a fascinating drug. But it is an opioid, and it is misusable, and it is diverted, and people do use it to get high. And there is a, it's not a perfect medicine. It's got a real street value now. And so broadening the availability is a very controversial thing. And even within the American Society of Addiction Medicine, there are fierce debates about the use of buprenorphine by general practitioners who don't understand addiction, who don't understand recovery, who don't require their patients to go to treatment, who are just willing to give them medications alone. And whether medications alone without any counseling at all is beneficial remains a very controversial area, and some researchers will say yes and others will say no. And so, from a political standpoint, I don't think you're going to see physician extenders being given prescribing authority. You may see some changes in the 100-patient limit, and it's a fascinating thing that the federal government says that any physician with a DEA registration can treat 1 million patients personally with pain meds to treat pain, but only 100 patients with buprenorphine to treat addiction that results
in pain. Why would that be?
Well, again, when the medicine came out, it was a political decision to make an exception to the Harrison Act of 1914 that's 100 years old today, that back in 1914 Congress said if a physician gives an opioid to an opioid addict to treat opioid addiction or withdrawal, it's a felony. So the Harrison Act of 100 years ago criminalized medical practice and said if you have the audacity to try to treat somebody with heroin addiction or opioid addiction with an opioid, you're breaking the law. And the only exceptions are methadone in methadone clinics only and buprenorphine with certified physicians only. And that's what your caller was talking about. Why not give the certification to prescribe buprenorphine to PAs and nurse practitioners? And that political decision is probably not going to be made anytime soon because buprenorphine is not without problems. I find it to be a very effective medicine, but it's not without problems. And I'm just glad to see that we now have the antagonists that are now getting more attention, the naltrexone products that aren't opioids but still keep you from being able to get high.
Yeah.
So that may be a whole other program, Kathleen.
Yeah, I'm sure there one's leading to another. Dr. Michael Miller is with us, medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. When we return, after a wee bit of a break, Wisconsin State Representative from the 89th Assembly District, John Nygren, will be joining us, and he has sponsored some bills in the legislature dealing with various aspects of addiction. He had horrors in his family. His daughter had a near-fatal overdose of heroin in 2009. So we'll be looking at legislation that needs to happen here and welcoming more phone calls, too. So if you're on hold, please stay where you are. We'll be with you soon. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Show, and we're on Twitter at KDenShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We mentioned this Wednesday a summit on the problem of heroin addiction in southeast Wisconsin. It's going to be at Marquette University. And the featured speaker is Representative John Nygren of Marinette. His daughter has been battling heroin addiction, and he has been authoring significant pieces of legislation here in the state of Wisconsin. He's from the 89th Assembly District, serving his fourth term in the state assembly, co-chair of the Joint Committee on Finance. We'll talk about those bills. And Dr. Michael Miller will remain with us, so we'll continue our phone calls as well. Representative Nygren, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. So you're the keynote speaker. Tell me about the bills and how you decided what bills you would fashion for the state of Wisconsin. What became most important to you as a result of your horrendous experience with your daughter?
Well, some are based on experience. The Narcan or Naloxone legislation, we're putting it in the hands of basic level EMTs, came because in Marinette, while we have a paramedic group assigned to our ambulance, if the first on the scene would have been the basic level volunteer EMTs, like a lot of our state has, they would not have been able to administer that Narcan. And as well as when we got home that day to find Cassie, her friends were leaving as we were, coming in the door. So we've seen anecdotally stories of young people being left in snowbanks and all different places throughout our state because friends are afraid to dial 911 to save a life because they're afraid of getting in trouble themselves. So. Mm-hmm. In those cases, that was personal experience. Many of the other things we did was from listening to, different stakeholders, the treatment community, parents themselves, law enforcement. So really, the conversation was pretty broad, and it continues to be pretty broad throughout our state. And that's one of the reasons why I'm continuing to, hit every town hall meeting, every summit, any whatever they call them. We're going to be there if we can to just listen and try and develop ideas that can be put into action in the future.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Miller, I know the two of you know each other. Do you, when you look at legislation, look at a specific piece of legislation that you would be very that would be helpful in this regard, no matter what the area, that you would like Representative Nygren to write and bring through the legislature?
He's doing a great job. In fact, the Wisconsin Medical Society gave him an award at our annual meeting in this year. We're very proud of the work he's done on this topic. Certainly, he has his own motives for doing this, but he has been an exemplary legislator, really not just coming up with what he thinks is the best idea, but really going to people and getting ideas. And I think this 911 legislation, so that if you make a good faith call to 911, it's a health call. It's not a police call.
Mm-hmm.
You won't get busted for trying to save somebody's life. He's exactly right. Making naloxone more available, not just through EMTs, but probably even through just the general public being able to get supplies and to use it and to rescue someone from an overdose situation. Over time, it's going to be much bigger than even Wisconsin, looking at the federal parity law and making sure that the insurance companies abide by it. And parity means that you offer insurance benefits that are on a par with benefits for medical surgical conditions and don't discriminate against people with mental illness or addiction. So we're going to have to do that. Something you mentioned, of course, is having people stay in treatment long enough, and parity should be able to take care of that. As long as insurance companies don't say, well, there's no medical necessity for professional help after 3 months. We never said for hypertension or diabetes. You wouldn't say, you've been seeing a doctor for 3 months for diabetes.
Yes.
You're done.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't do that. And anybody trying to do that for addiction, it doesn't make any sense. So I think the representative is doing a super job, and he tells us he has other ideas for the next session, and I eagerly await those.
And what about insurance, Representative Nygren? Did you have problems with Cassie in that regard, in terms of being able to access treatment and have a good chunk of it paid for it, or has that been problematic?
No, we did not have that problem. I'm fortunate. I'm a state employee. I work for the state of Wisconsin. My wife's a public school teacher. We've got great insurance. So that wasn't something that we experienced, but I know that that has been a discussion I've heard from other folks. And begin with, I was a little confused because I had known that we had parity for mental health and addiction was considered a mental health issue. But I guess it's how it's defined. If it's not defined as a medical necessity, then it can be looked at differently.
Yeah. I would imagine, you know, this is one of these issues. You must have been, in some ways, unless there were a lot of signs, flabbergasted that Cassie was using heroin, weren't you? I mean, it's become something that we know about now, but it wasn't that long ago. We didn't think it was very widespread. We didn't know that many young people were using it, did we?
No, I was shocked. I mean, my community is unfortunately somewhat of a hotbed for it because we had actually had a doctor back about 7-8 years ago that was selling prescriptions for OxyContin. And when he was arrested and sent to 3 years in prison, by the way, a pretty soft sentence in my
condition.
But he had addicted really a whole generation of young people. When the supply dried up, and at the same, right around the same time, OxyContin reformulated so that it was not as easy to crush and snort and to freebase. So the heroin dealers came in and happily fed the need that was there. So yeah, I remember her telling me that for a long, you know, the first time, and I was shocked. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and the only thing we knew about heroin was what we saw on TVs, and it was always rock stars and
right.
You know, people in inner cities and dark alleys doing heroin, not.
Mm-hmm.
Young, beautiful, you know, Wisconsin citizens and in small towns doing heroin. And but as we've learned, our area is not unique. It's pretty much, if it's not in your community yet, it will be soon. And the more parents become aware of it, the better off we're all going to be. I think that's probably the best thing that's come out of our discussion mm-hmm. about this issue is that more people are aware, people are talking, you know, we're doing programs like this. And if anybody is surprised that there's heroin in our state now, they shouldn't be.
No, absolutely. And you must see people from all kinds of backgrounds, right, Dr. Miller? It's not discriminate. It's rich, it's poor, it's everybody.
Absolutely. And they begin with pills. They say, I'll never snort a pill, but then they do. Then they say, I'll never snort heroin, then they do.
Yeah.
And they believe that as long as they're just using heroin nasally, that they're fine. As long as they don't go to IV, they're fine, and they're wrong. You can be terribly addicted even using it by the nasal route alone. And so this is the pattern. And tragically, it begins in almost all cases with prescription drugs that almost always begin at the medicine cabinet. And having parents lock up their meds, bring them to drop-off points, use the safe med drop systems in your county and community. And all of this is outlined in that website from Safe Communities in Madison. Every community should have an initiative like this. Fond du Lac's done some great things. There are many communities around our state that have citizen coalitions that are dealing with this in a very constructive way. And the National Government Association says it's one of our highest priorities. It's the number one cause of accidental deaths in the United States, more than any kind of falls, injuries, gunshots, or anything. And so everybody is paying attention because we must. And thank you for bringing so much good attention to this.
Yeah, it's our pleasure, yeah. See, I wish we didn't have to talk about it. Sandy, we have about a minute left. Sandy in Muskego, hi.
Hi, I'll be quick. I'm just wondering, our pharmacies in Wisconsin don't communicate to one another, is my understanding. So someone who is using painkillers can get prescriptions from multiple pharmacies. Is there any legislation at all?
That's about to change.
The prescription drug monitoring program has been in operation for several months now. We were unfortunately like the 37th state. We weren't early. Prescription drug monitoring program, if you Google PDMP, it now does exist in Wisconsin. We're starting to get the data, and the data is 2 million prescriptions in 1 year for Vicodin in Wisconsin.
Good
alone.
Grief. Oh, my gosh.
That's not pills.
There is a problem with that, however, is our PDMP is optional. The participation in it is non-mandatory, and we allow a window of up to 7 days for the information to be uploaded. So we are having conversations with the medical community about how we might be able to change that to make it a real-time tool, and I think you'll be hearing more about that in the future.
All right. We're plumb out of time. Thank you both so much for being with us. All those websites that you gave, we'll put them on our Facebook page. Give us a minute to do that, everybody. Representative Nygren, thank you very much for being with us. Let us know future legislation. We'll talk.
Will do.
Dr. Miller, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, John. Good luck at that summit in Milwaukee.
Yeah, the summit is this Wednesday at Marquette University. Contact them for more information. It should be a really good summit. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the program, and thanks to KP for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you tomorrow. We'll be speaking with the author of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, a book about how innovations continue to prove the catastrophes wrong, the author says. And we'll also be speaking with, we had somebody who did a report on the rocket ship charter school. It was highly critical. Tomorrow we will be giving Rocket Ship the ability to respond, and Tim Sheehy of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce will join us.